Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. We'll have an update for you today on a rash of measles cases around our county and a very long list of places where the public may have been exposed. On our Capitol Report, hear why Attorney General Eric Holder has halted a controversial federal program that allowed local police to keep a share of cash and other assets seized. We'll have news about a Chaldean church leader who is defying an order by Pope Francis, and how local Iraqi Americans here in East County are responding to this controversy over whether or not their priest should be forced to return to Iraq. Last year was the hottest year on record since 1880, and we'll have details on this finding from NASA and another federal agency. On Green Scene, learn about a critical vote that supervisors may take in early February, when the controversial Soitec solar projects will be heard, and why some East County residents and environmentalists are alarmed over the proposal for the Boulevard area. Hear about a bill passed by Congress to help prevent suicide among our veterans. And on Crime Beat, learn about an attempted rape in Santee. On Tribal Beat, hear about a change in policy by the Justice Department regarding marijuana growing on Native American reservations. Plus, hear about some vacancies on the board governing the Gillespie Field Airport. On Bookshelf, Raina Menashe interviews Timothy Daniels, a former special agent for ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, on his new novel and ongoing investigation. And then on Destination East County, Leon Thompson and Rebecca Williamson will tell you about some events coming up across East County, from a Canines and Cupid pet adoption event that's pure puppy love, to a family hike, concerts, and a circus coming to town. We'll have information on a cold case murder that the sheriff seeks public help to solve. Plus, we'll share some tips from the county on places where you can find classes, hikes, and activities to get fit and keep all those New Year's resolutions. You'll hear these stories and more, so stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. This is Miriam Raftery with a health report on a rash of measles cases in San Diego County. The outbreak has now climbed to 10 confirmed cases and 4 more suspected ones. Patients include 9 confirmed cases in East County and 1 in San Diego. The 4 suspected cases are in North County. All of these local cases so far are linked to people who visited Disneyland on December 18th, but people with measles locally visited many public places. So if you visited any of the locations they were at while they were contagious, you may have been exposed to the disease. Measles is highly contagious for up to 4 days before symptoms occur. You can get measles simply by breathing in the air next to an infected person. Measles had been declared eliminated in the U.S. back in 2000, but last year, 644 cases were reported in 27 states, many from people who visited other countries and were not vaccinated. A rise in parents who refuse to vaccinate their children has resulted in a resurgence in the disease, which can cause serious complications or even death. The vaccine is effective 99% of the time, though that leaves 1% of those vaccinated who can still contract measles. Symptoms appear 7 to 21 days after exposure. Early symptoms include high fever, red eyes, cough, and runny nose. A distinctive red rash appears 3 to 5 days later, starting on the face and head, and then spreading to the body, hands, and feet. Most Americans born in 1957 or later have had the measles, mumps, rubella, or MMR vaccine. The vaccine is recommended at 12 months of age with a booster shot between 4 and 6 years. There is no treatment for measles, though treatment may be needed for serious complications such as pneumonia or ear infections. Bed rest, fluids, and fever control medications are recommended. Here are the public places in San Diego County where exposures occurred. In East County, the CVS Pharmacy and Vons Supermarket, both on Fletcher Parkway in El Cajon, had exposures on January 14th. Also, Parkway Plaza Shopping Mall in El Cajon on December 29th, especially if you visited the Carousel, GameStop, and Sunglasses Hut. Sharp Reese Steele Urgent Care Clinic near Grossmont Hospital in La Mesa had measles patients on January 3rd and January 14th. Trader Joe's in La Mesa on January 12th. In Alpine, the Rite Aid Pharmacy on Alpine Boulevard on January 13th. In Julian, the Absolute Personal Fitness and Julian Fitness Center on January 9th. And in San Diego, the City of San Diego Operations Building on First Avenue on January 12th, 13th, and 14th. In North County, the Vista Community Clinic on January 16th. Sprouts Farmers Market on January 14th. And the Albertsons in Carlsbad on January 13th. Also in Carlsbad, the Regal Carlsbad 12 Theater on January 6th had measles patients. Phil's Barbecue in San Marcos on January 11th and the Iceplex skating rink in Escondido on December 30th also had public exposures, as well as the Sharp Reese Steely Urgent Care in Rancho Bernardo most recently on January 19th. Now, if you visited any of those places on those dates, watch for symptoms. If you suspect that you or a family member has measles, call to report it to your doctor before visiting so that precautions can be taken to avoid infecting others, the county urges. Many U.S. physicians have never even seen a case of measles before. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control reminds medical professionals to isolate patients suspected of having measles. Measles germs can remain in the air up to 2 hours after an infected individual coughs or sneezes. Measles is on the rise globally as well as in the U.S. One of the worst outbreaks is in the Philippines, where over 21,000 cases have been confirmed and more than 50,000 cases are suspected, according to the World Health Organization. The Centers for Disease Control posts updates for travelers on its site, as well as other resources on measles and the measles vaccine. For more information on measles, you can visit cdc.gov. For details on local cases and public exposures, see the San Diego County News Center. And to get information on vaccinations locally, call the county's immunization line at 866-358-2966 or visit sdiz.org.
Recently, East County Magazine reported on a federal policy called the Equitable Sharing Program that let local law enforcement agencies keep 80% of cash and other assets that they seized from motorists and other people even when no charges were filed and no search warrant was issued. Critics contended that the system led to corruption and unfairly deprived victims of their property. Now, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder has banned local and state law enforcement officers from seizing assets under the program unless there is a warrant or criminal charges filed. There are exceptions for cases involving child pornography, illegal firearms, or explosives. Holder states, quote, "With this new policy, effective immediately, the Justice Department is taking an important step to prohibit federal agency adoptions of state and local seizures, except for public safety reasons," unquote. A Washington Post investigation found that local and state police have made over 55,000 seizures of cash, cars, and property valued at over $3 billion since 2008 under the program, which was started after the 9/11 terrorist attacks in 2001. Those who had property seized by police had the burden of proof to show that it was acquired legally to get it back. A restaurant owner in Virginia wound up losing his restaurant during a long fight to get back over $17,000 in cash seized, money he needed to buy equipment and supplies. A public records request by East County Magazine found that the San Diego Sheriff's Office and the District Attorney's Office benefited substantially from the Equitable Sharing Program. Since 2004, the sheriff has kept $16 million from assets seized under the program, or an average of $1.5 million a year. Assets were returned to people in just 9 cases, we learned. The San Diego District Attorney's Office raked in nearly $2 million through the program over the past 5 years, UT San Diego reported. DA Bonnie Dumanis drew scrutiny after spending funds from asset seizures on political purposes, not law enforcement activities as the law requires, according to the American Civil Liberties Association. The ban applies only to seizures under the federal equitable sharing law. Assets may still be seized under state or local asset forfeiture laws as well as other federal programs. Holder says that asset forfeiture remains a critical law enforcement tool when used appropriately, providing unique means to go after criminal and even terrorist organizations. But he concludes, quote, "This new policy will ensure that these authorities can continue to be used to take the profit out of crime and return assets to victims while safeguarding civil liberties," unquote. Holder's action comes after a bipartisan congressional group sent him a letter urging him to end the equitable sharing program. David Harris, a constitutional law scholar at the University of Pittsburgh, has praised Holder's action to end the program. He concludes, quote, "It has been a civil liberties debacle and a stain on American criminal justice," unquote. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barrena.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a Capitol Report. The U.S. Supreme Court announced on Friday that it will take on the controversial issue of same-sex marriage. The court is expected to issue a ruling in June on whether or not it is constitutional for states to deny same-sex marriage, as well as whether or not states have to recognize same-sex couples who were previously married in another state. This case comes after the Supreme Court struck down key portions of the Defense of Marriage Act in 2013. Many speculated afterwards that the decision may lead to a later ruling that could make same-sex marriage legal in all states, although at the time of that ruling, the Supreme Court purposefully did not rule on the constitutionality of same-sex marriage itself. The current case before the court was based on petitions from couples in multiple states, including Ohio, Michigan, Kentucky, and Tennessee. All of these states currently deny same-sex marriage. The marriage ban in these states was recently solidified by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which upheld the ban. In the past, other federal appeals courts have struck down bans on same-sex marriage. This recent decision likely plays a part in the court's decision to tackle the issue and clarify the matter once and for all. 5 of the 9 justices have supported same-sex marriage in the past to greater or lesser degrees. Justice Elena Kagan even officiated at a same-sex marriage in Maryland, Time reports. The 4 conservative justices, however, have said that they believe the Supreme Court should not be deciding this issue and that it should be left to state legislators. Court analysts predict that Justice Anthony Kennedy is the likely swing vote who may determine whether same-sex marriage will soon be the law of the land throughout the United States. Coming up next, the Chaldean Corner on East County Magazine's radio show, bringing you news for and about our region's Iraqi Chaldean community.
Chaldean Church Patriarch Louis Sacco has issued a statement published in an Arabic language publication indicating that he refuses to recognize the authority of Pope Francis. Recently, we reported that Pope Francis had granted a request by St. Peter's Cathedral in El Cajon. The Pope agreed to overturn a decree issued by Chaldean Church Patriarch Louis Sacco, who last fall ordered approximately 10 priests in the U.S. to return to war-torn Iraq, including Father Noel Gorgas at St. Peter's. St. Peter's had appealed Sacco's decision to the Pope, contending that the order amounted to suicide for the priests since ISIS terrorists are murdering priests in Iraq. Sacco indicated that priests who refused his order would be stripped of the priesthood. But now the publication Al-Yatiyah has reportedly published a statement in its Arabic language edition from Patriarch Sacco in which Sacco refuses to recognize the Pope's authority over the Chaldean Church in the San Diego region, effectively defying the papal order. Patriarch Sacco says Chaldeans have been in Iraq for 2,000 years and that the Church has a mission to protect Christianity in Iraq for future generations, regardless of the dangers. If all the families leave and even the priests, the entire history and Chaldean Christian patrimony will vanish, he states. Sacco faults Bishop Jama for the appeal, stating that the priests are not his and warns believers do not be dragged into this action of the bishop. Patriarch Sacco's statement drew swift condemnation from Mark Arabo, president of the Neighborhood Market Association and a national spokesman for Chaldean Americans. We recognize the Pope's decision to be true and overarching, Arabo said. Any statement by a lesser authority cannot be recognized. The Pope's decision is not simply a solution, he concludes. It is the only solution. We look forward to seeing Father Noel every Sunday from now on out. East County is home to around 40,000 Chaldeans, so if Father Noel were dispatched to Iraq, it would leave the local church without enough priests to minister to displaced Iraqi Christians here, sources close to the local church leadership have indicated. Not everyone agrees that Father Noel should stay, however. In the comments section on East County Magazine's website, a poster named Cristobal stated that he thinks Father Noel should be ready to accept martyrdom, the courage, like Christ, to die for his religious beliefs. In related news, Pope Francis is reportedly considering a trip to Iraq, Al-Yatiyah reports, despite dangers posed to Christian religious leaders by Islamic State terrorists. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
Pope Francis announced on Monday his plan to visit 3 U.S. cities in September. This marks the first time since becoming Pope in 2013 that Francis will visit the U.S. He plans to visit Washington, New York, and Philadelphia. When he arrives, the Pope plans to meet President Barack Obama and speak at a special joint session of Congress. He will also speak at the United Nations during his stay in New York. He is also speculated to visit several prominent locations, including Ground Zero, and will hold Mass in each of the three cities. The Pope's visit will be important to Christians all across the U.S. Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York hails Pope Francis as the leading global voice on issues of social justice and income equality, UT San Diego reports. The Pope's words may carry weight all across the country. While in Washington, the Pope has also announced that he will canonize the missionary Father Junipero Serra, who built 9 missions across California, including the one right here in San Diego. This decision is not universally hailed, however. Many Native Americans have criticized the canonization of Father Serra based on his harsh treatment of the Native people. We aren't the only country seeing the Pope this year. He also has plans to visit the Central African Republic, Uganda, Bolivia, Paraguay, and Ecuador. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Hayden Parsley.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Last year was the hottest year on Earth since 1880, according to 2 separate analyses by NASA and by scientists at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. In addition, 9 of the 10 hottest years ever measured have occurred since 2000. This trend continues a long-term warming of the planet, according to an analysis of surface temperature measurements by scientists at NASA's Goddard Institute of Space Studies in New York. The Goddard Institute's director says the warming trend is largely driven by increase in carbon dioxide and other human emissions into the planet's atmosphere. The majority of that warming has occurred in the past 3 decades. Regional differences in temperature are more strongly affected by weather dynamics than the global average. For example, in the U.S. in 2014, parts of the Midwest and East Coast were unusually cool, while Alaska and 3 western states, California, Arizona, and Nevada, experienced their warmest years on record. But overall, the planet continues to heat up. Scientists at NASA and NOAA agree. NASA's analysis incorporates surface temperature measurements from 6,300 weather stations, ships, research stations in the Antarctic, and other data collection points. NOAA scientists used much of the same raw temperature data, but employ their own methods to estimate global temperatures. The Goddard Institute is a NASA laboratory managed by the Earth Science Division of the agency's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. The laboratory is affiliated with Columbia University's Earth Institute and the School of Engineering and Applied Science in New York. NASA monitors Earth's vital signs from land, air, and space, with a fleet of satellites, as well as airborne and ground-based observations, to see how our planet is changing. The agency works with institutions in the United States and around the world that contribute to understanding and protecting our home planet. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Hayden Parsley.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. On February 4th, county supervisors will hold a hearing on Soitec's controversial proposal to build 4 massive industrial-scale solar facilities in Rural Boulevard. Supervisors' decision could have a profound impact on the region's ecology and the quality of life of rural residents. Rural Planning Group chairs and environmentalists are blasting county planners for approving Soitec Solar's controversial projects, despite strong evidence that they could deplete groundwater supplies, threaten wildlife, and create fire hazards. There are also serious concerns over Soitec's precarious financial position. And at least one citizens group, Backcountry Against Dumps, or BAD, has promised to file a lawsuit against the county if supervisors do approve Soitec's projects, which would cover 1,500 acres with approximately 8,000 massive solar trackers, each 30 feet high. Boulevard's planning group voted unanimously to oppose these projects. 50 to 75 residents packed the meeting, all opposed to this radical transformation of their community, meadows, wetlands, and scenic areas. Donna Tisdale, chair of the Boulevard Planning Group, voiced alarm over last-minute changes to the project proposal after the environmental impact report was completed. Those changes include adding 150 battery modules, each the size of a large ocean shipping container, additions that could increase the risk of fire, Tisdale wrote in comments submitted to the county. After all, fires have occurred at other battery storage facilities elsewhere. She contends that such major additions violate the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, and that the environmental review process should be reopened as a result. In neighboring Hakumba Hot Springs, Hakumba Sponsor Group Chair Howard Cook has also raised serious concerns. The question is, why is the county even considering the changes in environmental damage this challenged foreign company will incur, he asks in a letter that he sent to supervisors. This huge project will industrialize an area of rural ranches located in an area with significant wildlife, with scenic beauty, and partially along an interstate highway, Highway 8, with a scenic designation, Cook adds. Both Tisdale and Cook claim the EIR vastly underestimates the project's water use. They have good reason for concern, since the Eco Substation project, just completed by SDG&E, used 3 times more groundwater than estimated, nearly 1 million gallons. Water is precious in an area dependent on groundwater, especially during drought conditions, but Soytech relied on the same consultants, Dudek, that have consistently underestimated water use at other projects in the region. Tisdale notes that residents in this area rely solely on groundwater and have no access to California Water Project's reservoirs or any other water sources. Therefore, she says, the developers in San Diego County are putting the lives, livelihoods, and homes of eastern San Diego County residents, as well as its largely tourist-oriented businesses, in jeopardy. San Diego State hydrology expert Victor Ponce studied this project and concluded it could destabilize the entire ecosystem by depleting groundwater resources beyond what would likely be replenished through rainfall. He concludes no development, no matter how lofty its aim, should place at risk existing natural ecosystems. He advised that if built, the Boulevard Soytech projects should import water for construction, not drain down groundwater resources. Cook and Tisdale want the county to vote down these projects. They contend that the EIR severely underestimates the amount of water that will be used. The EIR fails to include water estimates for road building or for constructing foundations to hold the massive array of batteries or even for washing the completed solar trackers. They also question the amount of water estimated for concrete, suggesting it could be several times higher than estimated. Objections to the projects have also come from the Nature Conservancy, California Fish and Wildlife Service, the Anza Borrego Desert State Park Foundation, and Mark Jorgensen, the former superintendent of Anza Borrego Desert State Park. Their concerns include fragmenting habitat for endangered desert bighorn sheep and golden eagles, among other species that stand to be negatively impacted. Some environmentalists also voice fears over depletion of water supplies for wildlife, including marshes that are part of the Pacific Flyway for migratory birds and water seeps that bighorn sheep rely on for survival. Another big concern is the financial stability of Soytech, which recently had its stock plunge to just a quarter of its former value. A Reuters analyst recommended that investors avoid Soytech stock, quote, like poison. Once a poster child for renewable energy and a recipient of a lucrative federal grant, French-based Soytech recently lost a lucrative solar contract with Tenasca in Imperial Valley. And this week, Soytech announced layoff of 100 local workers at its Rancho Bernardo factory. GreenTech Media reports that Soytech's concentrated photovoltaic, or CPV, factory is on its last legs due to financial losses and collapse of the CPV market due to competition from China and other technologies. Moreover, San Diego Gas and Electric spokesperson Jennifer Ramp revealed SDG&E does not have any contracts with Soytech, GreenTech Media reports. Ramp said SDG&E no longer has a direct business relationship with Soytech after the company previously worked very hard to bring Soytech to San Diego with a focus on helping them be successful. GreenTech concludes the signs are clear, this deal is toast, and the factory is in trouble. Despite such dire warnings of ecological collapse and serious questions about the survival of Soytech in the solar business, county planners approve the Soytech projects anyway. Now San Diego supervisors feel the pressure from Sacramento to comply with renewable energy mandates. But renewable energy could be met by producing power where it's used the most, in urban areas, with solar on rooftops and parking lots, to name just 2 reasonable alternatives. Backcountry leaders contend that putting the lives, water supply, and safety of East County residents at risk, along with the very existence of some of our region's most iconic wildlife species, would be irresponsible. And if the fears voiced by rural advocates, wildlife experts, and SDSU's hydrology expert prove true, will Soytech even be around to accept liability for the devastation? For those who believe that East County residents' lives and safety don't matter, consider this. If rural residents' lawsuit is successful, all county taxpayers could wind up footing the bill for damages resulting from approval by county supervisors of a deeply flawed project with potentially devastating consequences.
This is Leon Thompson with a crime beat report. A woman in Santee fought off an attempted rapist early Saturday morning. According to Sergeant Ting with the Sheriff's Department, the victim left the Second Wind Bar and was walking in the area of Prospect Avenue and Pepper Drive around 12:45 a.m. when she was assaulted by a man who knocked her to the ground, then tried to remove clothing from her lower body. The victim was able to kick the attacker, causing him to flee. The suspect is described as white in his mid-20s with short, light-colored hair. If you have information on this reported crime, you're asked to please call the Sheriff's Sexual Assault Unit at 858-974-2316. You can also remain anonymous and be eligible for up to a $1,000 reward for information leading to an arrest by calling Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8477.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a Capitol Report. The House of Representatives has unanimously passed H.R. 203, the Clay Hunt Suicide Prevention for American Veterans Act. This bipartisan legislation, originally passed by the House in the 113th Congress, but blocked by a single U.S. senator, addresses the epidemic of suicide among our nation's veterans. All five congressional members from San Diego County voted in support this week. Congresswoman Susan Davis issued this statement after the measure's passage. "Too many of our veterans are lost to suicide because the country they served and sacrificed for has not provided them with adequate support," said Davis. "This bipartisan legislation provides our heroes the care and support to help them overcome mental health challenges, traumatic brain injuries, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Everyone who served their country should feel that their nation stands behind them with compassion and dedication every day," she said. 22 veterans commit suicide every single day, more than 8,000 a year. Of the more than 2 million Americans who have served in combat in Afghanistan and Iraq, it is estimated that one-third, roughly 600,000 women and men, have traumatic brain injury, PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress syndrome, or depression. Named in honor of late Iraq and Afghanistan war veteran Clay Hunt, a noted suicide prevention advocate who committed suicide himself in 2011, the Clay Hunt Suicide Prevention for American Veterans Act will establish a peer support and community outreach pilot program to assist transitioning service members with accessing VA mental health care services. Also a one-stop interactive website to serve as a centralized source of information regarding all mental health services for veterans. A student loan repayment pilot program aimed at recruiting and retaining psychiatrists that will help address the shortage of mental health care professionals, and an annual third-party evaluation of all mental health care and suicide prevention practices and programs at the VA to find out what's working and what's not. The bill was introduced by Representative Tim Walz, a Democrat from Minnesota who is the highest-ranking enlisted soldier ever to serve in Congress, and co-authored by Chairman of the House Committee on Veterans Affairs, Jeff Miller, a Republican from Florida, along with Representative Tammy Duckworth, a Democrat from Illinois who is a triple amputee, Purple Heart recipient, Iraq War veteran, and a member of the Army National Guard.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. This is Leon Thompson with today's Tribal Beat. At the request of Native American tribes, the United States Department of Justice has issued a policy statement offering guidance to United States attorneys on priorities for enforcing marijuana laws on tribal lands. Given that many states have legalized marijuana for medical, agricultural, or recreational use, the statement lists 8 priorities for enforcement on tribal lands and makes clear that any enforcement must require consultation with tribal partners. The tribes have the sovereign right to set the code on their reservations, says Timothy Purden, U.S. Attorney for North Dakota, and Chairman of the Attorney General's Subcommittee on Native American Issues, U.S. News reports. Many have interpreted the Justice Department's statement as giving a green light for tribes that wish to cash in on growing marijuana for lawful uses to do so. And some California tribes are moving forward to do just that. On December 12th, the Department of Justice issued a statement saying that it would not interfere with Native American tribes who choose to legalize marijuana for medical, agricultural, and recreational use on tribal lands. An article on Native Times, a publication for Native Americans, reports. The federal statement appears to allow tribes that wish to grow marijuana for legal purposes to engage in cultivation, providing they don't trigger one of the 8 enforcement guidelines. Those triggers include distributing marijuana to minors, fueling revenues to criminal enterprises such as cartels or gangs, diverting marijuana to states where use remains illegal, using marijuana activity as a cover for other illegal activities, using firearms in cultivation or distribution of marijuana, drugged driving, or growing marijuana on public lands. But the Justice Department statement warns that nothing in the statement precludes investigation or prosecution, so some ambivalence remains. Still, some tribes are moving forward. The Pomo tribe in Mendocino County, California, is building a $10 million indoor marijuana growing facility near Ukiah, and that's come as a surprise to county officials. They are believed to be the first California tribe to build a large-scale cannabis cultivation facility. But according to the Riverside Press-Democrat, the same corporations that helped the Pomo tribe set up operations are now planning similar cultivation sites on tribal lands in southern and central California. State and local governments won't have much, if any, say-so about tribal marijuana cultivation in states where it's legal. Medical marijuana is legal in California, and in 2016, a ballot initiative is expected to ask voters whether or not to approve legalizing recreational use as well. Southern California is home to nearly 30 recognized Indian tribes, and there are 326 federally recognized tribes nationwide. While some market watchers had anticipated tobacco companies might have taken the lead in large-scale marijuana growing operations to fill demand in 23 states where some form of marijuana use is now legal, it now appears that Native American tribes will be first in the market. The marijuana cultivation industry, like casinos, could provide a lucrative source of income that could reduce the high rate of poverty that remains in many Indian nations, also providing jobs on the reservation. But not everyone is happy about the move. Some, such as Yakima tribe in Washington State, remain opposed to marijuana cultivation, the Los Angeles Times reports. Kevin Sabat, former advisor on drug issues to President Obama, has called the policy extremely troubling. He now directs the Drug Policy Institute at the University of Florida. Sabat observes that Native Americans and their families suffer disproportionately from addiction compared to other groups, particularly with alcohol, Sabat says. The last thing they want is another commercialized industry that targets them for greater use. But Dale Gerringer, California State Coordinator of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Law, sees tribal efforts to meet legal marijuana demand as a sign of the times.
The Gillespie Field Development Council has 3 open seats, including 2 seats representing El Cajon and 1 from the county. At its last meeting, the council voted against a proposal to expand the board from the current 5 seats to 7 seats. But some people, including Citizens Against Gillespie Expansion or CAGE, want to see a council that includes representation from citizens in the community, not just a board that represents government entities and pilots' interests. CAGE spokesman Robert German says his group supports 7 seats for a more balanced council with knowledge on real estate, non-aviation businesses, security and environmental issues related to noise, air, and water. He notes that the airport is the biggest real estate holding entity in the El Cajon Valley, with 852 acres. German adds, security is obviously a concern, as Gillespie has 4 flight schools training employees from all over the world, mainly China and the Middle East. Other San Diego County airports, including Fallbrook and Palomar, already have advisory boards that include seats for citizens, so residents in East County want to know why the county won't expand the Gillespie Council to give citizens here a voice, too. But that would mean even more seats to fill, and there are already 3 vacancies. Terms for the three open positions on the council are 4 years. The council meets on the third Wednesday of every other month, starting in January. If you would like to receive an application or have questions about these openings, you can contact the clerk for the Board of Supervisors at area code 619-531-5600. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Timothy Daniels, retired supervisory special agent of U.S. Customs, or ICE, and author of the new novel, An Ongoing Investigation. My guest, who has a long history of working with narcotic smuggling cases and money laundering, he brings a unique perspective to a border city like San Diego. An Ongoing Investigation is the sequel to his debut novel, A Target-Rich Environment, which was published in 2011. Welcome, Tim. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
And thank you for having me, Raina.
Let's begin with An Ongoing Investigation. I know the story is about a task force trying to stem the flow of narcotics coming into the U.S. from Mexico. Tell us a little bit more about what happens in the book.
Well, first, I would just like to say that I don't think most people that live in this area have any kind of clear understanding of how much narcotics come across the border just on a constant basis.
Right.
And it's thousands of pounds probably a day.
Really?
So as I neared the end of my career, I decided that I would like to try to write a book and, you know, kind of paint a picture of what it was like to work in the war on drugs, which unfortunately we're losing. But, you know, there's just a lot of stories that I accumulated over the course of my career, and I wanted people to understand, number one, the amount of drugs coming across, and then what it was like to be involved in the war on drugs, and, you know, tell some of those stories, explain how difficult it is on family life, and, you know, what it requires of somebody. So in my two books, I basically took a fictitious character, Jimmy Maxwell, and I put him in a fictional case that runs 4 or 5 months. But during the middle of that case, it's interspersed with a lot of little sub-stories of cases that I worked on, you know, where I changed some of the names and details to cover that up. But for the most part, the little sub-stories are true. The overarching story, not so much.
So you got a chance to both tell the small stories of what really goes on and give a message about this is what's happening in San Diego.
Yes. And in the first novel, I went into some of the politics involved, which were very frustrating to most of us that were involved in this kind of work. Not so much in An Ongoing Investigation. I basically made that more focused on Jimmy and his personal relationships and, you know, what it was like to be the target of somebody who was out there trying to get him.
Now, for how many years did you do this work?
About 23.
A wealth of experience.
Yes.
And you're retired now.
I retired at the end of 2009.
Okay. So your protagonist, Jimmy Maxwell, is he you or is he a combination of several people, made up?
He's partially me. I mean, I would like to say that I had his work ethic, and I certainly was as busy as he is in the book during the course of my career. I went through some of those same personal struggles that he goes through. But on the other hand, several of my agents that I used to work with have told me that I'm actually more Tom, his supervisor, the grumpy old guy who, you know, is having to approve everybody's reports and, you know, be that buffer between upper management and the guys working on the street. So, anyway, a little me. I will say that, Jimmy, my main character, is a bourbon drinker, and I'm right there with him.
And you're a bourbon drinker, okay. I know you worked for Operation Alliance, which was the San Diego division of the DEA, and in marine smuggling investigations. And it sounds terrible and exciting and important. Do you miss the excitement? Do you relive your work when you're writing, or
There's some of that. Operation Alliance is I spent 16 years of my almost 23 there. And that's mostly customs agents or now ICE agents. And then there's three or four DEA groups. And then there's a half a dozen local cops and a couple of other. I think we had an ATF agent and we had a couple of Border mm-hmm. Patrol guys. You know, and it was family. It was like family to me to a large degree.
Could you explain Operation Alliance?
It was a task force of a bunch of different agencies that mm-hmm. was formed to work smuggling cases in San Diego. So narcotic smuggling cases. And they respond both to the ports of entry, to seizures made by Customs and Border Protection, the uniform guys. Also, they did proactive work. Some of it stemmed from follow-ups to port cases. Some was just developed through informants. Some was tips through other law enforcement contacts, San Diego Police Department's mm-hmm. Narcotics teams. So we worked at kind of a wide variety of drug cases.
And you were a team, so when you work on the book, you're sort of making that team continue, would you say? Is that it?
Well, I'm trying to let the readers know what it was like to mm-hmm. be part of the team.
A window.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about what you said about the influence of family, how difficult it is on family. In your books, the love interest, Margie Gray, she worries about Jimmy Maxwell's safety and about other things. Now, with the safety of law enforcement in the news so much lately, is there anything you'd like to say about that? Was safety a big stressor on you and your family the way it is for your protagonist?
Not nearly as much, probably, as is portrayed in the book. Certainly, you know, we had our moments. I've been involved in search warrants where there were shootings and different things like that, and I was actually moved out of town for a couple of months with a handful of other agents after some threats came in against us. But for the most part, I didn't really spend a whole lot of time even thinking about that. The tougher part of the work is just being on call all the time. And,
right.
and sometimes you head out in the morning and you think you're coming home at 5, but you may not come home for several days.
Really?
You know?
Okay.
You know, because you just don't know where the case is going to take mm-hmm. you. But as for safety, local police have a far riskier job than we did as federal agents.
I see.
Because they're dealing with people that they really don't know. They respond to a radio call or pull somebody over for a traffic ticket, and you don't know if it's some guy on the 10 most wanted list or
right.
somebody that just hacked his wife up. Whereas normally we knew who we were targeting, so we took the appropriate amount of people with us to deal mm-hmm. with that.
Could you tell us briefly one of the little stories in your book? Could you share with the listeners?
Well, one of the funny little stories involved an older lady who was in her late 70s, a white lady, and she came across the border one Friday night, and there was about 28 or 29 pounds of marijuana in the trunk of her car. And so I was interviewing her, and she just said, look, I went down with some friends of mine who live out here in El Cajon, and I had dinner, and I was getting tired, and they just said, take my car and go home. So I gave her a notice to appear. I tended to believe her. She told me who they were and the registration on the car matched.
Uh-huh.
So on Monday morning, I took another agent friend and a El Cajon police detective, and we went and knocked on the door of this couple.
Uh-huh.
The man who opened the door was wearing a pair of leopard skin bikini briefs. His legs were about 3 inches in diameter, you know, and he had a little belly and almost bald, had probably 3 chest hairs. And then he invites us in, and, you know, we tell him why we're there. And his wife comes out, and she sits in front of us and does the Sharon Stone leg cross thing. And so I decide that, I would like to take a look around the house because he's denying everything.
Uh-huh.
Well, as we are looking around the house, there's a lot of adult-themed things, toys
right.
and gadgets.
Uh-huh.
And at one point, I went over to a closet and opened the door, and for about a half a second, I see this body falling out on me. And I actually pulled my gun. It startled me it was dark.
Uh-huh.
But it turned out it was a blow-up doll.
Oh,
and
goodness.
So, of course, my partners were all teasing me that if I would have shot it would have went zipping around the room like a you know, balloon that got popped or something.
Okay. So you never know if something's going to be dangerous, serious, or a little bit light.
Or a little humorous.
Yeah, a little humorous. One last question, Tim. Tell us what's next in your sequel. I understand that you're writing sequel. When should we expect to see that?
Well, I haven't really decided whether or not I'm going to do another one. I'm leaning heavily towards it. Uh-huh. An ongoing investigation kind of ends just before 9/11, so I'm thinking of trying to write a story that will incorporate a little bit of that into it.
Mm-hmm.
But quite honestly, I haven't worked out all the details yet. Both of these other books that I've written took about a year each. If I can get started in the next couple of months, you know, obviously it would be about a year from now before it would come out.
Well, we look forward to seeing it.
Well, I look forward to doing something productive with in my retired years here.
So. And Tim, our time is up, but thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
For more information on Timothy Daniels and his work, please visit his publisher's website at sbpra.com/Timothy Daniels. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Rebecca Williamson.
And Leon Thompson, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This week's Destination East County has events ranging from a Sock Monkeys concert at a wine tasting room in La Mesa to an art show and family nature walk at Mission Trails Regional Park. Plus, we'll have a preview of coming attractions including Cupids and Canines, pet adoption event at Grossmont Center, to Circus Vargas bringing in its show to El Cajon. Stay tuned for all of these events and much, much more from East County Magazine.
Mission Trails Regional Park is displaying works of 7 award-winning artists in one show. The works created in a variety of mediums are on display now through January 30th in the Visitor Center Art Gallery. For details, visit missiontrailsregionalpark.org.
On Friday night, January 24th, from 7 to 10 p.m., the Sock Monkeys will perform at the San Pasqual Winery Tasting Room in La Mesa's downtown village at 8364 La Mesa Boulevard. The group plays music from past to present, also mixing in their original music during a spirited evening. Wine is available by the glass. Desserts, cheese, and crackers are also available. For more information, visit sanpasqualwinery.com.
Felix Cavalier's Rascals are coming to the Poway Center for the Performing Arts Foundation on Saturday, January 24th at 8 p.m. Felix Cavalier is best known as the keyboardist and lead singer of the 1960s Young Rascals, king of blue-eyed soul and later pop and jazz fusion. The group later became the Rascals. Hits include Groovin', Good Lovin', A Beautiful Morning, and more. The tickets and details, you can visit the Poway Center for Performing Arts.org.
Mission Trails Regional Park Trail Guides will lead a guided nature walk for the whole family on Sunday, January 25th, from 3 to 4 p.m. Meet at the Visitor Center for a free walk, which provides a good opportunity for some family time together enjoying nature. Along the trail, discover the many seasonal changes that occur in the park throughout the year.
A 90-year-old pipe organ has been restored at La Mesa's Central Congregational Church at 8360 Lemon Avenue in La Mesa, which will host a concert to celebrate completion of the restoration on Sunday, January 25th at 3 p.m. The concert will feature classical and sacred works by Bach, Mendelssohn, Franck, and Widor, performed by Robert Plimpton, resident organist at First United Methodist Church in San Diego. Plimpton has also performed weekly concerts at Spreckles Pipe Organ in Balboa Park and has played with local orchestras as well as teaching at San Diego State University.
Circus Vargas will bring its newest performance, Arlequin, to the parking lot at Parkway Plaza Shopping Mall in El Cajon from February 5th through the 9th. The circus features an array of dazzling performers, including aerialists, acrobats, clowns, and more. For details and tickets, visit circusvargas.com.
Grossmont Center invites you to surround yourself with puppy love. The shopping mall in La Mesa will hold a Cupids and Canines pet adoption event on February 7th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Over 100 dogs and puppies from 17 local rescue groups will be at Grossmont Center looking for a loving home. You will be able to meet, play, and learn more about each canine. Plus, you will find your perfect match. You can adopt and take home a furry new member of the family just in time for Valentine's Day.
La Mesa Police Chief Ed Aceves will speak at a La Mesa Chamber of Commerce breakfast on Tuesday, February 10th at 7:30 a.m. at the Marie Callender's Restaurant in La Mesa. Chief Aceves will share his thoughts and vision for La Mesa as he hands over the reins of the police department to the next chief. Florio, a dance theater musical production, will be presented on February 8th at 2 p.m. in the Muette Dance Studio, which is located in Lemon Grove. The show features the indigenous dancing and costumes of Mexico. If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more on our calendar in our festivals and events section online at eastcountymagazine.org.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
San Diego Crime Stoppers and the San Diego County Sheriff's Department Homicide Unit are seeking public help for leads in the cold case disappearance of Cynthia Diane Coleman under suspicious circumstances. On September 3, 1986, the 23-year-old woman left her home on the Barona Indian Reservation to go to a nearby supermarket to give away a litter of kittens. Cynthia's mother reported her daughter missing on September 8, 1986, after she failed to return home and made no contact with her family. At the time of her disappearance over 27 years ago, Cynthia stood 5'1" tall and weighed about 110 pounds. She had long brown hair and brown eyes. Cynthia had "Fats" tattooed on her right hand and "Lady" tattooed on her left hand. According to the North American Missing Persons Network home, Cynthia Coleman did end up making it to the corner store the day she went missing. A friend of her brother's reportedly told authorities that he gave her a ride part of the way back to her home. The friend was questioned extensively and given a lie detector test, but no arrests were ever made. Cynthia was never seen or heard from again. She left her purse, her cigarettes, and her baby daughter. Both sheriff's investigators and family suspect foul play. If she is still alive, she will be 52 years old on January 30th. Anyone with information on the disappearance of Cynthia Diane Coleman is asked to call the sheriff's homicide detail at 858-974-2321. Or the Crime Stoppers Anonymous tip line at 888-580-8477. Anonymous email and text messages can be sent via www.sdcrimestoppers.com. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Hayden Parsley.
With the arrival of a new year, people make ambitious resolutions, and many of them, including my own, seem to focus on getting fit, losing weight, or just living a more active lifestyle. According to the website Statistic Brain, losing weight was the number one resolution made on January 1st last year. 62% of Americans make a resolution at least occasionally, but according to Forbes, only 8% of people achieve their New Year's resolutions. If you want to improve your odds of success, the County of San Diego has hundreds of activities throughout the year at a variety of skill and interest levels. Many of them are free or low cost, and they take place in locations all over the county. The San Diego County Library has over 350 health and fitness events in January alone. The library has an online calendar of events that list all of them, searchable by location, date, and age group. Yoga, dance classes, Zumba, nutrition and cooking classes, meditation, and martial arts are just a few of the types of offerings at the library. All library events are completely free. San Diego County Parks and Recreation Department also has a wide range of activities for all ages. hiking, sports leagues, equestrian opportunities, dance classes, yoga, and fitness boot camps are all offered at various county parks or community centers. The online parks activity guides list all the locations, times, and costs, if any, for all events. One of the most popular activities in the parks is hiking. There are miles of hiking, biking, or equestrian trails on the county's 30 parks and open space preserves. There are simple strolls along quiet streams for a leisurely hike, while experienced hikers looking for a challenge can hike rugged mountains and isolated valleys. San Diego County has one of the most diverse trail systems in the nation. Most of our trails are multi-use and have been designed to accommodate hikers, bikers, and horse riders. For more information, you can visit the parks website at sandiegocounty.gov/parks. This has been Ed Barreno with a public service announcement from the County of San Diego.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barreno, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.